two guards. The first object which struck D'Artagnan's sight on entering the room was Brisemont, extended on the floor, writhing in most horrible convulsions. Planchet and Fourneau, looking as pale as corpses, were endeavouring to assist him, but it was evident that all aid was useless. The features of the dying man were contracted with agony.
"Ah!" cried he, when he perceived D'Artagnan. "You pretended to forgive me, and you poison me!"
"I, wretch, I!" exclaimed the young man. "What can you mean?"
"I say that it is you who gave me the wine, and it is you who told me to drink it. You wanted to take your revenge. Oh, it is dreadful!"
"Do not think so, Brisemont," said D'Artagnan, "for I swear—"
"Oh, but God is there! God will punish you! My God, may you one day suffer what I suffer now!"
"Upon the gospel," cried D'Artagnan, rushing towards the dying man, "I swear that I knew not that this wine was poisoned, and also that I was about to drink it as well as yourself."
"I do not believe you!"
exclaimed the soldier, and he expired in exaggerated tortures. "Horrible, horrible," muttered Athos, whilst Porthos broke the bottles, and Aramis, rather late, it must be confessed, sent off for a confessor. "Oh, my friends," said D'Artagnan, "you have now again saved my life, and not mine only, but the lives of these gentlemen also. Gentlemen," continued he, addressing the guards, "may I request your silence concerning this catastrophe? Persons of high condition may be implicated in what you have now seen, and the misery of it all would fall upon us."
"Ah, sir," stammered out Planchet, more dead than alive. "Oh, sir, what a narrow escape I have had!"
"What, you rascal!" cried D'Artagnan. "Were you going to drink my wine?"
"To the king's health, sir! I was going to drink one little glass, if Fourneau had not said that someone called me."
"Alas," said Fourneau, whose teeth were chattering with fright, "I wanted to get rid of him, that I might drink some myself."
"Gentlemen," said D'Artagnan, addressing the guards, "you must be aware that our entertainment would be but a melancholy affair after what has passed. I beseech you, therefore, to receive my excuses, and let us postpone it till some other day." The two guards courteously accepted these apologies, and understanding that the four friends wished to be alone, they took their departure. When the young guard and the three musketeers were without witnesses, they looked at one another for an instant, in a way which proved how well they understood the seriousness of their situation. "First," said Athos, "let us quit this room. A dead man is but sorry company." "Planchet," said D'Artagnan, "I recommend you to look to the body of this poor devil, and see that it is buried in consecrated ground. He had committed a crime, it is true, but he had repented of it." Having entrusted the funeral rites of Brisemont to Planchet and Fourneau, the four friends quitted the room. The host gave them another chamber, and furnished them with fresh eggs, whilst Athos himself fetched water for them from the well. Aramis and Porthos were, in a few words, informed of all that had occurred.
"Well," said D'Artagnan to Athos, "you see, my dear friend, it is war to the death."
Athos shook his head.
"Yes, yes," said he, "I see it well enough. But are you sure that it is she?"
"Perfectly.
Nevertheless, I confess that I have still some doubts."
"But that fleur-de-lis upon her shoulder?
It is an English woman who has committed some crime in France and has been branded in consequence."
"Athos, it is your wife, I tell you," repeated D'Artagnan. "Do you not remember how the two marks agree?"
"And yet I should have thought that the other was dead. I had hanged her so thoroughly."
It was D'Artagnan who shook his head this time.
"But after all, what is to be done?" said the young man. "The fact is that it is impossible to remain in this manner, with a sword always suspended over one's head," replied Athos. "And you must get freed from such a situation."
"But how?"
"Listen. Try to find her, and to come to an understanding with her. Say to her, 'Peace or war. On the honor of a gentleman, I will never say one word or take one step to injure you. On your part, give me a solemn oath to remain neutral with respect to me. If not, I will go to the Chancellor, to the King, and to the Executioner. I will excite the court against you, and will declare you branded. I will cause you to be tried, and if you are acquitted,
Well then, on the word of a gentleman, I will kill you myself as I would a mad dog.
I like this plan well enough, said D'Artagnan, but how am I to find her?
Time, my dear friend, time brings opportunity. Opportunity is man's martingale. The more one has shipped, the more one gains when he knows how to wait.
Yes, but to wait surrounded by assassins and poisoners.
Ah, said Athos. God has preserved us hitherto, and God will preserve us still.
Yes. Besides, we are men, and after all, it is our business to risk our lives.
But she, added D'Artagnan in a low voice. And who is she? Asked Athos.
Constance.
Madame Bonacieux?
True, I had forgotten, said Athos.
Poor fellow, I forgot that you were in love.
Well, said Aramis, but did you not see, by the very letter that you found on the wretch who was killed, that she was in a convent? One is quite safe in a convent, and as soon as the siege of La Rochelle is ended, I promise you, on my own part...
Good, said Athos, good. Yes, my dear Aramis, we know that your views all tend towards religion.
I am only a musketeer temporarily, said Aramis meekly.
It would seem that he has not heard from his mistress for a long while, said Athos in a whisper to D'Artagnan. But do not make any remark. We know it.
Well, said Porthos, it seems to me that there is a very simple means.
And what is that? Demanded D'Artagnan.
She is in a convent, you say? Continued Porthos.
Yes.
Well, as soon as the siege is raised, we will take her out of this convent.
But first we must know what convent she is in.
Ah, that is true, said Porthos.
But do you not say, my dear D'Artagnan, said Athos, that it is the queen who has chosen this convent for her?
Yes, I believe so, at least.
Well, then, Porthos will help us in that case.
How so, pray? Asked Porthos.
Why, through your marchioness, or duchess, or princess. She ought to have a long arm.
Hush! Said Porthos, putting his finger on his lips. I fancy she is a cardinalist, and she must know nothing about it.
Then, said Aramis, I undertake to get some news of Madame Bonacieux.
You, Aramis? Exclaimed the three friends. You, and how so?
Through the queen's almoner, with whom I am very intimate, answered Aramis, blushing.
On this assurance, the four friends, who had ended their simple repast, separated, with the promise of meeting again the same evening. D'Artagnan returned to the Minim, and the three musketeers went to the king's quarters, where they had to provide themselves with lodgings. 43. The Red Dovecote Tavern. Almost as soon as he had reached the camp, the king, who was in great haste to find himself before the enemy, and who participated in the cardinal's hatred of Buckingham, wished to complete the preparations, first for driving the English from the Isle of Ré, and then for forcing the siege of La Rochelle. But in spite of all his endeavours, he was retarded by the dissensions which broke out between de Bassompierre and Schomberg against the Duke of Angoulême. Schomberg and de Bassompierre were marshals of France, and insisted on their right to command the army under the superintendence of the king. But the cardinal, apprehensive that Bassompierre, who was a Huguenot at heart, might fight feebly against the English and the Rochellois, who were his co-religionists, supported the Duke of Angoulême, whom his Majesty had, at his instigation, already made Lieutenant General. The result was that with the alternative of seeing Schomberg and Bassompierre desert the army, they were compelled to give each a separate command. Bassompierre took his station at the north of the city, from Lannion to Dompierre. The Duke of Angoulême took his to the east, from Dompierre to Périgny, and Schomberg to the south, from Périgny to Angoulême. His Royal Highness fixed his quarters at Dompierre. His Majesty was sometimes at Étrée, and sometimes at Jarry, and the Cardinal established himself at a simple house, without any entrenchment, at Pont de la Pierre, upon the Downs. Thus His Royal Highness overlooked Bassompierre, the King, the Duke of Angoulême, and the Cardinal, Monsieur de Schomberg. As soon as this arrangement had been established, they had occupied themselves in driving the English from the isle. The conjuncture was favourable. The English, who, above all things, required to be well fed in order to prove good soldiers, eating only salted provisions and bad biscuits, had many invalids in their camp, and, moreover, the sea, which was, at that season of the year, highly dangerous on all the western coasts,
was every day disastrous to some small vessel or other, and the shore, from the point of L'Aiguillon to the trenches, was literally strewed at every tide with the wrecks of pinnaces, cutters, and feluccas. The result was that should the king's troops even keep within their camp, Buckingham, who remained in the Isle of Ré only from obstinacy, would sooner or later be obliged to raise the siege. But as Monsieur de Thoiras announced that everything was preparing in the enemy's camp for a new assault, the king concluded on adopting final measures, and issued the necessary orders for a decisive affair. Our intention being not to make a journal of the siege, but merely to record those events in it which bear upon the history we are relating, we shall be contented with stating that the enterprise succeeded to the great satisfaction of the king and the great glory of the cardinal. The English, beaten back foot by foot, conquered in every encounter, trodden down in their passage from the isle, were compelled to re-embark, leaving on the field of battle 2,000 men, amongst whom were 5 colonels, 3 lieutenant colonels, 250 captains, and 20 gentlemen of quality, as well as 4 pieces of cannon and 60 flags, which last were conveyed to Paris by Claude de Saint-Simon, and suspended with great pomp to the arched roof of Notre-Dame. Te Deums were sung in the camp, and soon spread themselves thence throughout the whole of France. The cardinal was thus at liberty to carry on the siege, without having, at least for the time, any reason to be apprehensive of the English. But, as we have just said, the security was only momentary. An envoy of the Duke of Buckingham, one whose name was Montague, having been seized, they found upon him proofs of a league between the Empire, Spain, England, and Lorraine. This league was formed against France. And in the quarters of Buckingham, which he had been forced to abandon precipitately, there had been found papers confirming, as the cardinal declares in his memoirs, the existence of this league, and compromising greatly Madame de Chevreuse, and consequently the Queen. It was upon the cardinal that all the responsibility rested, for a man can never be an absolute minister without being responsible. On this account, all the resources of his vast genius were exerted by night and day, and occupied in listening to the last breath that stirred in any one of the great realms of Europe. The cardinal was well aware of the activity, and above all of the hatred of Buckingham. If the league which threatened France should triumph, all his influence would be lost. The policies of Spain and Austria would have each its representatives in the cabinet at the Louvre, where they had as yet only partisans. He, Richelieu, the French minister, the minister emphatically national, would be ruined. And the king, who, even whilst he was obeying him like a child, hated him as a child hates its masters, would abandon him to the combined vengeance of his Royal Highness and the Queen. He should be ruined himself, and perhaps France with him, and these were disasters that he was bound to prevent. On this account, couriers, becoming more numerous every instant, were seen succeeding each other by night and by day at that small house, at the Pont de la Pierre, in which the cardinal had fixed his home. There were monks who wore the monastic habit so ill that it was easy to recognize them as belonging to the church militant. Women, a little awkward in their pages' costumes, the looseness of whose dresses would not entirely conceal their rounded forms. And countrymen, with blackened hands but fine limbs, who might be known for men of quality at a league's distance. Other visits, too, there were, more disagreeable. For it had been 2 or 3 times reported that the cardinal had narrowly escaped assassination. It is true that the enemies of his eminence declared that it was he himself who had employed these unskillful assassins, so that he might, on occasion, have the right of retaliation. But we should believe neither what ministers say, nor what their enemies say. Yet this did not prevent the cardinal, whose most violent detractors never called in question his personal courage, from making many nocturnal expeditions. Sometimes to communicate important orders to the Duke of Angoulême, sometimes to enter into council with the king, and sometimes to confer with some messenger whom he did not choose to have admitted to his own abode. The musketeers, on their side, not having much to occupy them in the siege, were not very strictly controlled, and led a merry life. This was the more easy to our 3 companions especially, as, being friends of Monsieur de Treville, they readily obtained from him special permissions to absent themselves, even after the hour at which the camp was closed. Now, one evening, when D'Artagnan, who was in the trenches, could not accompany them, Athos, Porthos, and Aramis, mounted on their chargers, enveloped in their service cloaks, and with their hands on the butt-ends of their pistols, were returning together from a tavern, which Athos had discovered 2 days before on the La Jarrie road, and which was called the Red Dovecot. They were proceeding on the road toward the camp, keeping a good lookout for fear of an ambuscade, when, about a quarter of a league from the village of Boineau, they thought they heard the sound of horses coming towards them. They all immediately halted, in close rank, and waited, keeping in the middle of the road. After a short time, and just as the moon emerged from behind a cloud, they saw, coming round the corner of the road, two horsemen, who, upon perceiving them, halted also, appearing to deliberate whether they should advance or retreat. This hesitation excited the suspicion of our three friends, and Athos, advancing a few paces, cried out in his firm voice, "Who goes there?"
"Who goes there yourself?" replied one of the two horsemen.
"That is no reply, that," said Athos. "Who goes there? Answer, or we charge!" "Take care what you are about, gentlemen," said a sonorous voice, which appeared to be accustomed to command. "It is some officer of rank who is making his nightly rounds," said Athos, turning towards his companions. "What will you do, gentlemen?"
"Who are you?"
said the same voice, in the same commanding tone.
"Reply, or you may find yourselves in some trouble for your disobedience."
"King's musketeers," answered Athos, more than ever convinced that he who thus questioned him had the right to do so.
"Of what company?"
"Company of Treville."
"Advance, and give an account of what you are doing here at this hour."
The three companions advanced, with their ears a little drooping, for they were all now convinced that they had to deal with one more powerful than themselves. They left Athos to be their spokesman. One of the two horsemen, he who had spoken the second time, was about 10 paces before his companion. Athos made a sign to Porthos and Aramis to remain in the same manner in the rear, and advanced alone.
"Excuse us, sir," said Athos, "but we did not know who you were, and you may see that we kept a good lookout."
"Your name?" said the officer, who covered part of his face with his cloak.
"But you yourself, sir," said Athos, who began to be indignant at this questioning,
"give me, I beg, some proof that you have the right thus to question me."
"Your name?" said the cavalier a second time, letting his cloak fall so that his countenance might be seen.
"The cardinal!" cried the astounded musketeer.
"Your name?" repeated his eminence a third time.
"Athos," said he.
The cardinal made a sign to his equerry, who approached him.
"These three musketeers will follow us," said he in a low voice. "I do not wish it to be known that I have left the camp, and by making them follow us we shall be certain that they will not tell anyone."
"We are gentlemen, my lord," said Athos. "Ask us for our words, and do not be in doubt about us. Thank God we know how to keep a secret."
The cardinal fixed his piercing eyes upon the daring speaker.
"You have a fine ear, Monsieur Athos," said the cardinal. "But now listen to this. It is not through distrust that I request you to follow me. It is for my own security. Undoubtedly, your two companions are Messrs. Porthos and Aramis."
"Yes, your eminence," said Athos, whilst the two musketeers came forward, hat in hand.
"I know you, gentlemen," said the cardinal. "I know you. I am aware that you are not entirely my friends, and I am sorry for it. But I know that you are brave and loyal gentlemen, and that you may safely be trusted. Monsieur Athos, do me the honor, therefore, to accompany me with your two friends, and then I shall have an escort which might excite the envy of His Majesty if we should meet him."
The three musketeers bowed to the very necks of their horses.
"Well, then, upon my honor," said Athos, "your eminence is right to take us with you. We have met some sinister faces on the road, and we have even had a quarrel with four of them at the Red Dovecot."
"A quarrel? And on what account, gentlemen?" said the cardinal.
"I do not like rufflers, you know."
"That is exactly why I've had the honor to warn your eminence of what has just happened, for you might hear it from others, and, from a false report, be induced to believe that we had been at fault."
"And what were the consequences of this quarrel?" demanded the cardinal, frowning.
"Why, my friend Aramis there has received a slight wound in the arm, which, however, as your eminence may see, will not hinder him from mounting to the assault tomorrow if your eminence commands the attack."
"But you are not the kind of men to take wounds in that way," said the cardinal.
"Come, be frank, gentlemen.
You certainly gave some in return. Confess yourselves. You know that I have the right to pronounce absolution.
I, my lord, said Athos, did not even draw my sword. But I took him, with whom I was engaged, up in my arms and threw him out of the window. And, continued Athos, with some slight hesitation, I fancy that in falling he broke his thigh.
Ah, ah, said the cardinal.
And you, Monsieur Porthos?
I, my lord, knowing that swordplay is forbidden, seized a bench and gave one of these brigands a blow which, I think, broke his shoulder.
Very well, said the cardinal. And you, Monsieur Aramis?
I, my lord, as I am naturally very gentle, and am, besides, as your eminence perhaps does not know, on the point of taking orders, I wanted to lead away my companions, when one of these wretches treacherously stabbed me through the left arm. My patience then failed me. I drew my sword in turn, and as he returned to the charge, I fancy that I felt, as he threw himself upon me, that the weapon passed through his body. I only know that he fell, and seemed to be carried away with his two companions.
"The fiend, gentlemen," said the cardinal. "Three men disabled in a tavern quarrel. You have rather active hands. But, by the way, what was the cause of the quarrel?"
"These wretches were drunk," said Athos, "and knowing that a lady had arrived at the tavern that evening, they wanted to force her door."
"And was this woman young and pretty?" demanded the cardinal, with some anxiety.
"We did not see her, my lord," replied Athos.
"You did not see her? Ah, very good," briskly replied the cardinal. "You did right to defend the honour of a woman. And as I am myself going down to the Red Dovecot, I shall know whether you have told me the truth." "My lord," proudly replied Athos, "we are gentlemen, and would not tell a lie to save our lives."
"Nor do I doubt what you have told me, Monsieur Athos. No, not for one moment.
But," added he, to change the conversation, "was this lady alone?"
"The lady had a cavalier closeted with her, but as he did not show himself, in spite of the noise, it is to be presumed that he is a coward."
"Judge not rashly, says the gospel," replied the cardinal. Aramis bowed.
"And now, gentlemen," said the cardinal, "I know what I wanted to learn. Follow me."
The three musketeers fell behind the cardinal, who again covered his face with his cloak, and went forward, keeping himself 8 or 10 paces before his four companions. They soon arrived at the silent, solitary tavern. The landlord was unquestionably aware what an illustrious visitor he was to expect, and had dismissed all troublesome persons. 10 paces before he reached the door, the cardinal made a sign to his equerry and to the three musketeers to halt. A ready-saddled horse was fastened to the shutter. The cardinal knocked 3 times, in a peculiar manner. A man, enveloped in a cloak, came out directly, and quickly exchanged a few words with the cardinal, after which he mounted the horse and went off towards Surgrès, which was also the road to Paris.
"Come forward, gentlemen," said the cardinal. "I find that you have told me the truth, gentlemen, and it will not be my fault if our meeting this evening should not turn out to your advantage. In the meantime, follow me."
The cardinal dismounted, and the three musketeers did the same. The cardinal cast his bridle over the arm of his equerry, and the musketeers fastened theirs to the shutters. The landlord stood on the step of his door. To him, the cardinal was only an officer coming to visit a lady.
"Have you any chamber on the ground floor where these gentlemen may wait for me by a good fire?"
inquired the cardinal. The landlord opened the door of a large room, where a sorry closed iron stove had lately been replaced by a large and excellent chimney.
"I have this," replied he.
"That will do excellently," said the cardinal. "Enter, gentlemen, and be pleased to wait for me here. I shall not be more than 30 minutes."
And whilst the three musketeers entered the chamber on the ground floor, the cardinal, without requiring any direction, ascended the stairs, like a man who has no need to be told the way. 44. The Utility of Stove Funnels. It was evident that, unconsciously, and moved solely by their chivalrous and adventurous character, our three friends had rendered a service to someone whom the cardinal honoured with his own especial protection. But who was that someone?
This was the question which our three musketeers first asked themselves. Then, finding that none of the replies which their intelligence suggested were satisfactory, Porthos called the landlord and asked for some dice. Porthos and Aramis placed themselves at a table and began to play, whilst Athos walked up and down the room in deep thought. As he walked and meditated, he passed and repassed before the funnel of the former stove, which had been half broken off, and of which the other end went into the apartment above. Each time that he passed, he heard the murmur of speech, which at last attracted his notice. Athos approached, and distinguished some words, which certainly appeared to deserve so much attention, that he made signs to his two companions to be silent, and remained himself with his ear bent down to the level of the lower opening of the funnel. "Listen, my lady," said the cardinal. "The business is important. Sit down and let us talk about it."
"My lady," muttered Athos.
"I am listening to your eminence with the greatest attention," replied a voice which made him start. "A small vessel with an English crew, whose captain is devoted to me, awaits you at the mouth of the Charente, at the Fort de la Pointe. It will sail tomorrow morning."
"I must go there tonight, then?"
"Directly. That is to say, as soon as you have received my instructions. Two men, whom you will find at the door when you go out, will escort you. You will let me depart first, and then, half an hour after, you will depart yourself."
"Yes, my lord. Now, let us return to the commission which you are pleased to charge me, and, as I am anxious to continue to merit your confidence, deign to explain it in clear and precise terms, so that I may not make any error."
There was a moment of profound silence between the two interlocutors. It was evident that the cardinal was weighing beforehand the expressions he was about to use, and that the lady was collecting all her intellectual faculties to understand what he was going to say, and to engrave it on her memory when it was said. Athos took advantage of this moment to tell his two companions to fasten the door inside, and to beckon them to come and listen with him. The two musketeers, who loved their ease, brought a chair for each of themselves, and one for Athos. They all three seated themselves, with their heads close together, and their ears wide open. "You are going to London," resumed the cardinal. "On arriving there, you will seek out Buckingham."
"I would observe to your eminence," said her ladyship, "that since the affair of the diamond studs, in which the Duke has always suspected me, his Grace mistrusts me."
"But you have no occasion this time," said the cardinal, "to gain his confidence. You are to present yourself frankly and loyally as an ambassadress."
"Frankly and loyally?" repeated the lady, with an indescribable accent of duplicity.
"Yes, frankly and loyally," replied the cardinal, in the same tone. "All this business must be transacted openly."
"I will follow your eminence's instructions to the very letter, and I wait for you to give them."
"You will go to Buckingham from me, and you will tell him that I am aware of all the preparations he is making, but that I do not much disturb myself about them, seeing that, at the first step on which he ventures, I will destroy the Queen."
"Will he believe that your eminence is in a condition to execute your threats?"
"Yes, for I am in possession of proofs."
"It will be necessary for me to be able to submit these proofs to his examination."
"Certainly. And you will say to him first that I shall publish the report of Boisrobert and of the Marquis de Beautru concerning the interview which the Duke had with the Queen at the house of the High Constable's lady on the evening that the latter gave a masked ball. And you will add, in order to leave him no room for doubt, that he came in the costume of the Great Mogul, which was to have been worn by the Duke of Guise, and which he bought of this latter for the sum of 3,000 pistoles.
"Good, my lord."
"All the details of his entry into the Louvre, where he introduced himself in the character of an Italian fortune-teller, and of his leaving in the night, are known to me. And you will tell him, in order that he may be again assured of the accuracy of my information, that he had, under his cloak, a large white robe, thickly covered with tears and death's heads and crossbones, in which, in case of surprise, he was to personate the phantom of the White Lady, who, as is well known, revisits the Louvre whenever any great event is about to be accomplished."
"Is that all, my lord?"
"Tell him that I know all the particulars of the adventure at Amiens,
and that I shall make a little spiritually turned romance of it, with a plan of the garden and the portraits of the principal actors in that nocturnal scene. I will tell him this. Tell him further that I have got Montague in the Bastille. It is true we found no letter on him, but the torture may make him tell all he knows, and even a little more.
Perfect.
And lastly, add that his Grace, in his hurry to leave the Isle of Ré, forgot to remove from his quarters a certain letter of Madame de Chevreuse, which strangely compromises the Queen, inasmuch as it proves not only that Her Majesty can love the enemies of the King, but also that she can conspire with the enemies of France. You now thoroughly comprehend all that I have told you, do you not?
Your Eminence shall judge. The High Constable's Lady's Ball, the night at the Louvre, the evening at Amiens, the arrest of Montague, and the letter of Madame de Chevreuse.
That is right, my lady. That is right. You have an excellent memory.
But, resumed she to whom the Cardinal had just addressed this compliment, if, in spite of all these reasons, the Duke should not surrender and should continue to menace France?
The Duke is in love like a madman, or rather like a ninny, replied Richelieu with intense bitterness. Like the paladins of old, he has only undertaken this war to obtain a glance from his mistress's eyes. If he knows that the war will cost the lady of his love her honor, and perhaps her liberty, I warrant you that he will look twice at it before he decides.
But yet, said the lady, with a perseverance which proved that she was determined to understand all that was included in the mission that she was about to undertake, but yet, if he should persist...
If he persists, said the Cardinal, but it is not probable.
It is possible, rejoined the lady.
If he persists...
His Eminence paused, and then continued.
If he persists, well, I must put my hope in one of those events which change the fortune of nations.
If your Eminence would cite to me some of those historical events, said her ladyship, I might possibly participate in your confidence concerning the future.
Well, look, for example, said Richelieu, when, for a cause very similar to that which now actuates the Duke, His Majesty Henry the Fourth, of glorious memory, went in 1610 to invade at the same time both Flanders and Italy, in order that he might assail Austria on both sides, did not an event occur which saved Austria? Why should the King of France not have the same good fortune as the Emperor?
Your Eminence alludes to the assassin's knife in the Rue de la Ferronnière?
Precisely so, said the Cardinal.
Is your Eminence not afraid that the fate of Ravaillac would deter those who might be for an instant tempted to imitate his example?
In all times and all countries, especially in those countries which are divided within by religious faith, there are always fanatics who will be well contented to be regarded as martyrs. And here, at this very moment, it occurs to me that the Puritans are furious against the Duke of Buckingham, and that their preachers speak of him as the Antichrist.
Well?
Inquired her ladyship. Well, continued the Cardinal, in a careless tone, it would be only necessary, for instance, to find some young, beautiful, and clever woman who wanted to take revenge upon the Duke. Such a woman may be found. The Duke has been a favoured lover, and if he has sown much affection by his promises of eternal constancy, he has also sown much hatred by his continual infidelities.
Unquestionably, remarked her ladyship coldly, such a woman may be found.
Well, such a woman would, by putting the knife of Clément or of Ravaillac into the hands of an assassin, save France.
Yes, but she would be an accomplice in assassination.
Have the accomplices of Ravaillac or of Jacques Clément ever been discovered?
No, for they were perhaps too high in station for anyone to dare to seek them where they really were. It is not for everybody, my lord, that the Palace of Justice would be burned down.
What? Do you not believe, then, that the burning of the palace was an accident of chance? Asked Richelieu, in the very tone with which he would have asked the most unimportant question.
"Aye, my lord," replied her ladyship, "I have no belief about it. I cite a fact, nothing more.
Only I would say that if I were called Mademoiselle de Montpensier, or the Queen Marie de Medici, I should take fewer precautions than I do now that I am simply named Lady de Winter.
That is quite fair, said Richelieu. What is it, then, that you require?
I require an order ratifying beforehand whatever I may think it necessary to do for the prosperity of France.
But we must first find the woman I alluded to, who craves revenge upon the Duke.
She is found, said the lady.
Then we must find out the wretched fanatic who will serve as the instrument of God's justice.
He shall be found.
Well, said the cardinal, it will then be time enough to solicit the order that you have just demanded.
Your Eminence is right, resumed her ladyship, and I was to blame for seeing in the mission with which you honour me anything beyond what it in truth embraces. That is, to announce to His Grace in Your Eminence's name that you are aware of the different disguises under which he contrived to approach the Queen at the entertainment given by the constable's lady. That you have proofs of the interview which the Queen granted at the Louvre to a certain Italian astrologer, who was no other than the Duke of Buckingham. That you have given directions for a spiritual little romance concerning the adventure at Amiens, with a plan of the garden in which it occurred, and portraits of the actors who took part in it. That Montague is in the Bastille, and that the torture may make him tell all that he remembers, and even much that he does not remember. And finally, that you possess a certain letter from Madame de Chevreuse, which was found in His Grace's quarters, and which strangely compromises not only her who wrote it, but also her in whose name it has been written. But if he persists in spite of these representations, as this is the limit of my commission, it will only remain for me to pray to God to perform a miracle for the salvation of France. This is my precise mission, is it not, my lord? And I have nothing else to do?
Exactly so, said Richelieu coldly.
And now, continued her ladyship, without appearing to observe the altered manner of His Eminence towards her, since I have received Your Eminence's instructions with regard to your enemies, will your lordship permit me to say a few words concerning mine?
You have enemies, then? Said Richelieu.
Yes, my lord, enemies against whom you are bound to support me, since I made them in the service of Your Eminence.
And who are they? Demanded the cardinal.
There is, first, a little busybody of the name of Bonancieux.
She is in prison at Nantes.
That is to say, she was there, replied the lady. But the Queen has inveigled an order from the King, by the assistance of which she has removed her to a convent.
To a convent? Said the Cardinal.
Yes, a convent.
And in what convent?
I do not know. The secret has been well kept.
I will know it, though.
And Your Eminence will let me know in what convent this woman is?
I see no objection to that, replied the Cardinal.
Very well. Now I have another enemy, whom I fear far more than this little Madame Bonancieux.
Who is that?
Her lover.
What is his name?
Oh, Your Eminence knows him well, exclaimed the lady, carried away by her anger. It is the evil genius of both of us. It is he who, in an encounter with Your Eminence's guards, turned the victory in favor of the King's musketeers. It is he who gave 3 sword wounds to De Wardes, Your Eminence's emissary, and who rendered the affair of the diamond studs abortive. And lastly, it is he who, knowing that it was I who had deprived him of Madame Bonancieux, has sworn my death.
Ah, ah, said the cardinal, I know who you mean.
Yes, I mean that wretch D'Artagnan.
He is a bold fellow, that, said the cardinal.
And it is exactly because he is a bold fellow that he is the more to be feared.
We ought first, said the cardinal, to have some proof of his association with the Duke.
A proof! Exclaimed the lady. I will have 12.
Well, then, let me have the proof, and it is the simplest thing in the world. I will send him to the Bastille.
Very well, my lord. But then, afterwards?
When a man is in the Bastille, there is no afterwards, said the cardinal in a hollow voice. Ah, mordieu, continued he, if it was as easy for me to get rid of my enemy as it is to rid you of yours, And if it was against such people as these that you asked me for impunity...
My lord, said the lady, boon for boon, life for life, man for man. Give me the one, and I will give you the other.
I do not understand what you mean, replied the cardinal, nor do I wish to do so. But I shall be glad to oblige you, and I see no objection to giving you the order you demand, as to such an insignificant creature as this. And the more willingly, as you tell me that this little D'Artagnan is a libertine, a duelist, and a traitor.
A wretch, my lord, a wretch!
Then give me a pen, ink, and paper, said the cardinal.
Here they are, my lord.
Perfect. There was a moment's silence, which proved that the cardinal was occupied in thinking of the words in which the order should be written, or perhaps in writing it. Athos, who had not lost one word of the conversation, took a hand of each of his companions and led them to the other end of the room.
"Well," said Porthos, "what do you want, and why do you not let us hear the end of the conversation?"
"Hush," said Athos in a whisper. "We have heard all that was necessary for us to hear. Besides, I do not hinder you from hearing the rest, but I must go."
"You must go," said Porthos. "But if the cardinal should ask for you, what are we to say?"
"You will not wait for him to ask. You will tell him beforehand that I am gone in advance to clear the way, since from certain words of our landlords I have been led to suppose that the road is not quite safe. I will drop a word or two to the cardinal's equerry. The rest concerns myself. Do not be uneasy about it."
"Be prudent, Athos," said Aramis.
"Make yourself easy," replied Athos. "You know that I am cool enough."
Porthos and Aramis returned to their places near the funnel. As for Athos, he went out without any disguise, took his horse, which was fastened along with those of his two friends, to the shutter, convinced the equerry in four words of the necessity of an advance guard on their return, looked with affected care at the priming of his pistols, put his sword between his teeth, and set off as a forlorn hope on the road that led towards the camp. 45. A conjugal scene. As Athos had foreseen, the cardinal was not long before he descended. He opened the door of the room in which he had left the three musketeers, and found Porthos and Aramis engaged in a most earnest game of dice. With a rapid glance, he examined every corner of the room, and saw that one of his men was missing.
"What has become of Monsieur Athos?" he asked.
"My lord," replied Porthos, "he is gone forward on the lookout, as some remarks of our landlords led him to suspect that the road was not safe."
"And what have you been doing, Monsieur Porthos?"
"I have won 5 pistoles from Aramis."
"And can you now return with me?"
"We are at your Eminence's command."
"To horse, then, gentlemen, for it is getting late."
The equerry was at the door, holding the cardinal's horse. At a little distance, 2 men and 3 horses were visible in the shade. These men were the individuals who were to conduct her ladyship to the Fort de la Pointe and to superintend her embarkation. The equerry confirmed what the 2 musketeers had already told the cardinal concerning Athos. Richelieu gave a sign of approbation and resumed his journey, taking the same precautions in his return as he had done in his advance. Let us leave him on his way to the camp, protected by the equerry and the 2 musketeers, and return to Athos. For 100 yards he had preserved the same pace, but once out of view he had pushed his horse to the right, had made a small circuit, and had returned to within 20 paces, where, concealed in the coppice, he awaited the passage of the little troop. Having recognized the laced hats of his companions and the gold fringe of the cardinal's cloak, he tarried till the party had turned the corner of the road, and having lost sight of them, he galloped up to the tavern and was admitted without any difficulty. The landlord recognized him again.
"My officer," said Athos, "has forgotten a communication of importance which he should have made to the lady on the first floor, and has sent me to repair his forgetfulness."
"Go up," said the landlord. "The lady is still in her chamber."
Athos availed himself of this permission and descended the stairs with his lightest step, and when he had reached the landing place he perceived, through the half-open door, the lady who was fastening on her hat. He entered the room and closed the door behind him. Enveloped in his cloak, and with his hat drawn down over his eyes, Athos stood upright before the door. On seeing this figure, mute and motionless as a statue, the lady was alarmed.
"Who are you, and what do you want?"
exclaimed she.
"Yes, it is indeed she," muttered Athos. Letting his cloak fall and lifting up his hat, he advanced towards her ladyship. "Do you recognize me, madame?" said he. The lady took one step forward and then recoiled as though she had seen a serpent. "Come," said Athos. "I can see that you recognize me."
"The Count de la Fère,"
muttered her ladyship, growing deadly pale and drawing back till the wall prevented her retreat. "Yes, my lady," replied Athos. "The Count de la Fère in person, who returns expressly from the other world to have the pleasure of seeing you. Let us sit down, then, and converse," to quote the cardinal. Impelled by an inexpressible terror, her ladyship sat down without uttering a word. "You are a demon let loose upon the earth," said Athos. "Your power is great, I know. But you know also that with God's assistance men have often overcome the most terrible demons. You have once before crossed my path. I thought that I had crushed you, madame. But either I deceived myself, or hell has given you new life." At these words, which recalled most fearful memories, the lady held down her head and groaned. "Yes, hell has given you new life," resumed Athos. "Hell has made you rich. Hell has given you another name. Hell has almost endowed you with another face. But it has not expunged either the brand from your body or the stains from your soul." The lady arose, as if moved by a spring, and her eyes darted lightning. Athos remained seated. "You thought me dead, did you not?" he continued. "As I thought you dead. And the name of Athos has concealed the Count de la Fère, even as the name of Lady de Winter has concealed Anne de Breuil? Was that not what you were called when your honored brother married us?" "Our position is truly strange," continued Athos, laughing. "We have both of us only lived till now because each thought the other dead, and remembrance is less burdensome than a reality, although a remembrance even is sometimes a voracious thing."
"But after all," said the lady in a hollow voice, "what brings you here to me, and what want you with me?"
"I want to tell you that although I have been invisible to you, I have not lost sight of you."
"You know what I have done?"
"I can recite your actions day by day, from your entrance into the cardinal's service until tonight." A smile of incredulity passed across the pale lips of her ladyship. "Listen. It is you who cut the two diamond studs from Buckingham's shoulder. It is you who stole away Madame Bonancieux. It is you who, enamored of De Wardes, and thinking to receive him, opened your door to Monsieur d'Artagnan. It is you who, believing that De Wardes deceived you, wished to have him slain by his rival. It is you who, when this rival had discovered your disgraceful secret, sought to have him assassinated in his turn by two murderers whom you sent to dog him. It is you who, when you found bullets fail, sent poisoned wine with a forged letter to make your victim fancy that it was the present of his friends. And lastly, it is you who, here in this very room, seated on the very chair where I now sit, have this moment made an engagement with the Cardinal Richelieu to get the Duke of Buckingham assassinated, in exchange for his undertaking to allow you to assassinate Monsieur d'Artagnan." Her ladyship was livid.
"You must indeed be Satan," said she.
"Perhaps so," replied Athos. "But at all events, mark this well. Assassinate the Duke of Buckingham, or cause him to be assassinated, it is of no consequence to me. I know him not, and he is, besides, the enemy of France. But touch not one single hair of the head of D'Artagnan, who is my faithful friend, whom I love and will protect, or I swear to you by my father's head that the crime which you have then committed, or attempted to commit, shall be indeed your last."
"Monsieur d'Artagnan has cruelly insulted me," said she, "and he must die."
"Indeed! And is it possible that you can be insulted, madame?" said Athos, laughing. "He has insulted you, and he must die."
"He shall die," repeated her ladyship. "She first, and he afterwards."
Athos felt his brain begin to reel. The sight of this creature, who had nothing of the woman in her nature,
recalled most fearful recollections. He thought how one day, in a situation less perilous than that in which he now stood, he had already sought to sacrifice her to his honour. His murderous desire came burning back upon him, like an invading fever. He arose in his turn and put his hand to his belt, from which he drew a pistol, which he cocked. The lady, pale as a corpse, endeavoured to cry out, but her frozen tongue could only utter a hoarse sound, which had no resemblance to the human voice, but seemed rather the growl of some savage beast. Glued, as it were, against the sombre tapestry, with her dishevelled hair, she looked like the appalling image of terror. Athos slowly raised the pistol, stretched forth his arm until the weapon almost touched the lady's forehead, and then, in a voice the more terrible, as it had all the intense calmness of an inflexible resolution, "Madame," said he, "you must immediately give me the paper which the cardinal wrote just now, or on my soul I will blow out your brains." With any other man the lady might have had some doubt, but she knew Athos. Nevertheless, she remained motionless. "You have 1 second in which to decide," continued he. The lady saw, from the contraction of his brow, that the shot was coming. She hastily put her hand to her bosom, and drew forth a paper, which she handed to Athos. "Take it," said she, "and may you be accursed!" Athos took the paper, replaced the pistol in his belt, went to the lamp to assure himself that it was the right paper, unfolded it, and read, "It is by my order, and for the good of the state, that the bearer of this did that which he has now done. Richelieu." "And now," said Athos, resuming his cloak and replacing his hat upon his head, "and now that I have drawn your teeth, bite if you can." He left the room without even looking once behind him. At the door he found the two men with the led horse. "Gentlemen," said he, "his lordship's order is, you know, to conduct this woman, without loss of time, to the Fort de la Pointe, and not to leave her until she is on board." As these words exactly accorded with the order which they had received, they bowed their heads in token of assent. As for Athos, he sprang lightly into his saddle and went off at a gallop. Only, instead of keeping to the road, he went across the fields, pushing his horse on very fast, and halting from time to time to listen. In one of these halts he heard the sound of several horses on the road. He did not doubt that it was the cardinal and his escort. Taking immediately another direction forward, and then rubbing his horse with some sweet broom and leaves, he placed himself in the middle of the road, at not more than 200 paces from the camp. "Who goes there?" cried he, when he heard the horsemen. "It is our brave musketeer, I believe," said the cardinal. "Yes, my lord," replied Athos. "It is he in person." "Monsieur Athos," said Richelieu, "accept my best thanks for the care that you have taken. Gentlemen, we have reached our destination. Take the gate to the left hand. The word for the night is Roi et Ray." As he said this, the cardinal bowed to the three friends and turned to the right, followed by his equerry, for on that night he slept in the camp. "Well," said Porthos and Aramis, as soon as the cardinal was out of hearing, "well, he signed the paper that she demanded." "I know it," said Athos quietly, "for here it is." The three friends did not exchange another word before they reached their own quarters, excepting to give the word to the sentinels on guard. But they sent Mousqueton to tell Planchet that his master was requested, on leaving the trenches, to come immediately to the musketeer's rooms. On the other hand, as Athos had foreseen, her ladyship, on finding the two men at the door, followed them without hesitation. She had, for an instant, an idea of seeking another interview with the cardinal, and relating to him what had passed, but a revelation on her part would produce one on that of Athos. She might easily say that Athos had ruined her, but he would state that she was branded. So she thought it better to be silent, to depart discreetly, to accomplish with her accustomed ability the difficult commission which had been entrusted to her, and then, when these things were ended to the cardinal's satisfaction, to return and claim her vengeance. Consequently, having travelled all night, she was at Fort de la Pointe by 7 in the morning. At 8 she had embarked, and at 9 the vessel weighed anchor and made sail for England. 46. The Bastion of Saint-Gervais.
On arriving at his friend's quarters, D'Artagnan found them assembled in one room. Athos was thinking, Porthos was twisting his moustache, and Aramis was reading his prayers in a charming little book bound in blue velvet.
"By my soul, gentlemen," said D'Artagnan, "I hope that what you have to tell me is worth the trouble. Otherwise I should not forgive your having made me dismantle a bastion entirely by myself. Ah, why were you not there, gentlemen? It was hot work."
"We were in another place, where it was by no means cold either," said Porthos, giving his moustache a turn peculiar to himself.
"Hush," said Athos.
"Oh, oh," said D'Artagnan, understanding the slight frown of the musketeer. "It seems that there is something fresh astir."
"Aramis," said Athos, "you breakfasted at the Parpaillot Tavern the day before yesterday, I believe?"
"Yes."
"How are things there?"
"Why, I fared but badly myself. It was a fast day, and they had nothing but meat."
"What," said Athos, "in a seaport, and no fish?"
"They say that the mound which the cardinal is building drives the fish out into the open sea," said Aramis, resuming his pious reading.
"But that is not what I wanted to know, Aramis," continued Athos. "Were you free, and did no one disturb you?"
"Why, I think that there were not many idlers," replied Aramis. "Yes, in fact, for what you want, Athos, I think we shall do well enough at the Parpaillot."
"Come, then, let us to the Parpaillot," said Athos, "for here the walls are like leaves of paper."
D'Artagnan, who was accustomed to his friend's manner, and understood by a word, a gesture, or a look from him, that circumstances called for seriousness, took his arm and went out with him without uttering a word.
This is the end of disc number 14. Please insert disc number 15. This is disc number 15.
D'Artagnan, who was accustomed to his friend's manner, and understood by a word, a gesture, or a look from him, that circumstances called for seriousness, took his arm and went out with him without uttering a word. Porthos followed them in conversation with Aramis. On their way, they met Grimaud, and Athos beckoned to him to attend them. Grimaud, according to custom, obeyed in silence. The poor fellow had finished by almost forgetting how to speak. When they arrived at the Parpaillot, it was 7 in the morning, and the day was just beginning to dawn. The three friends ordered breakfast, and entered a room where the landlord assured them that they would not be disturbed. The hour was, unfortunately, ill-chosen for a conference. The morning drum had just been beaten. Everyone was busy shaking off the sleepiness of night, and to drive away the dampness of the morning air, coming to take a drop at the tavern. Dragoons, Swiss, guards, musketeers, and light cavalry succeeded one another with a rapidity very beneficial to the business of mine host, but very unfavorable to the designs of our four friends, who replied but sullenly to the salutations, toasts, and jests of their companions.
"Come," said Athos, "we shall bring some good quarrel on our hands presently, and we do not want that just now. D'Artagnan, tell us about your night's work. We will tell you about ours afterwards."
"In fact," said one of the light cavalry, who, whilst rocking himself, held in his hand a glass of brandy, which he slowly sipped,
"in fact, you were in the trenches, you gentlemen of the guards, and it seems to me that you had a squabble with the Rochellois."
D'Artagnan looked at Athos, to see whether he ought to answer this intruder who intruded on the conversation.
"Well," said Athos, "did you not hear Monsieur de Busigny, who did the honor to address you? Tell us what took place in the night, as these gentlemen seem desirous to hear it."
"Did you not take a bastion?"
asked a Swiss, who was drinking rum mixed with a glass of beer.
"Yes, sir," replied D'Artagnan, bowing. "We had that honor. And also, as you may have heard, we introduced a barrel of powder under one of the angles, which, on exploding, made a very pretty breach, without reckoning that, as the bastion is very old, all the rest of the building is much shaken."
"And what bastion is it?"
asked a dragoon, who held spitted on his sabre a goose which he had brought to be cooked.
"The bastion Saint-Gervais," replied D'Artagnan, "from behind which the Rochellois annoyed our sappers."
"And was it warm work?"
"Yes,
We lost 5 men, and the Rochellois some 8 or 10.
Ballsambleu! Said the Swiss, who, in spite of the admirable collection of oaths which the German language possesses, had got the habit of swearing in French.
But it is probable, said the light horseman, that they will send pioneers to repair the bastion this morning.